And I would like start by saying that in the landscape of different instruments of fundamental rights protection, the Charter is still a rather recent addition, which, despite its relative youth, has shown a significant ability to play the role as a corrective, as a sort of corrective, especially vis-à-vis public regulatory powers, but not limited to that only. However, the use of the Charter is not always straightforward, even complex at times. And it is fair to say that that complexity may stem, to some extent, simply from uncertainties about the applicability, if in a given case before a national judge, of the underlying rule of EU law. For example, it may not be clear what degree of harmonization has been attained in a given area, or there might be doubts as to the applicability ratio ne temporis of European law, for instance, in respect of a certain pre-accession situation that still has some effects after the accession, etc. So these may not be easy questions, and yet the reply to those questions and as well others will have a direct effect upon the applicability of the Charter. So the second point to be mentioned is that the Charter can be used for different purposes. It is, of course, a tool of interpretation. EU law and national law implementing that law must be interpreted in compliance with it. But the Charter can be also relied on as a yardstick for validity of EU law acts, and also to test the applicability of the underlying, of the implementing national law. And third, the Charter may sometimes raise the issue of its interaction with national instruments of protection of fundamental rights and international instruments, among which the European Convention of Human Rights. So with that in mind, I'm going to spend a couple of minutes addressing the very basic premises that underlie the applicability of the Charter in the national legal orders, because the relevance of those premises keep returning to the front lines. And then I'm going to look at the different angles from which one may address the Charter. And then I'm going to turn to some recent cases to flesh out those aspects. So I'm not going to spend much time with the older case law, with some exceptions, but I'm going to look rather at some recent examples. So when addressing the scope of application of the Charter in the national legal orders, the necessary point of departure is, of course, Article 51, and especially its paragraph 1, which elucidates that issue by providing that the Charter is addressed to the EU institutions and to the member states when, as regards the member states, they are implementing EU law. That means that the requirement that flow from the Charter does not extend to situations which are of purely national nature. In other words, for the Charter to apply and become legally relevant for the national judge, the situation presented before the judge must involve a rule of EU law which is different from the provisions of the Charter itself, because the Charter itself is, of course, part of EU law. So that has been expressed in what has today become a very well-known metaphor, referring to the Charter as being the shadow of EU law, to bear out precisely the idea that when EU law applies, the Charter must follow, and therefore there cannot be a situation in which EU law would apply while the Charter would not. That also means, on the other hand, that the Charter cannot apply proprio motu, so to speak, in the absence of other applicable EU law, because as a disciplined shadow, the Charter cannot be walking alone without the object that actually triggers its projection. And that triggering object is precisely another rule of EU law. It should be added at that point that the premise of the applicability of the charter being tightly locked with the applicability of other EU law reflects the concern for the vertical division of powers between the Union on the one hand and the Member States on the other hand, and for the respect of the principle of conferral of powers that governs the activities of the EU law, of EU institutions, and that principle must be also replicated at the level of the Member States when they are acting to implement EU law. So to place the current situation perhaps in a broader perspective, it is good to recall that starting premise, which we find today in the first paragraph of Article 51, represents in reality a continuity with the situation as it existed in the period prior to the entry of the Charter into force, during which EU fundamental rights existed as general principles of EU law derived from the common constitutional traditions of the Member States and from international standards of protection. And although there were doubts in that respect when the Charter was entering into force, due especially to the use of the term implementing in the first paragraph of Article 51, which may seem narrower than the term of scope of EU law, for instance, the Court confirmed in the seminal judgment of Akerberg-Franzen the relevance of those previous developments and made it clear that the concept of implementation, which is used in Article 51, must be indeed understood in broad sense as including situations that are covered by EU law, that are within the scope of EU law, which had been already made clear in the pre-existing case law. Now, I would like to open a small parenthesis from the perspective of national law, of the perspective of national courts, who may be dealing with a case that makes it useful or even mandatory in some situation to refer a question for the preliminary ruling to Luxembourg. So from that perspective, it is relevant that the very same idea of the Charter being firmly locked with other EU law is reflected at the stage of the verification of the question whether Court of Justice has at all jurisdiction to reply to the questions which are put to it. And Akerberg-Franzen illustrates that point quite well, which further bears out that the limits that flow from the division of powers between the Union and the Member States mean that the Court cannot be answering questions which in reality concern only interpretation of national law, even though if the reference includes a mention of a specific provision of the Charter. Now, coming back to Article 51 of the Charter, as expressed at the level of the general principle, and also as explained by the Court in Akerberg-Franzen, the question of applicability of the Charter in the national legal orders of the Member States may appear almost limpid. However, that prima facie simplicity actually hides a certain degree of complexity when it is scrutinized in more detail, because the actual link with EU law may be more or less obvious depending on the circumstances of the case. So, turning to the specific scenarios in which the Charter may appear before a national judge, there are indeed various angles from which the role of the Charter may be looked at. Or perhaps, to put it differently, there may be three main questions to be asked when dealing with the Charter. The first one, and the most important one, of course, is whether there are any relevant links that connect the situation before the national judge to EU law. And once this question is clarified, the next question is, why is it that I want to use the Charter? Is it to seek a specific interpretation of a EU law provision, or is it because perhaps there might be doubt about validity of an act of EU law? And then, depending on the circumstances of the case, it may be also relevant to clarify the interplay between the Charter and the domestic instrument of protection of fundamental rights, or international instrument of protection of fundamental rights, among which especially European Convention of Human Rights. When it comes to the starting question, whether the situation involves implementation of EU law within the meaning of Article 51, that question is the most frequently explained through the concepts of agency and derogation situations as being two broad scenarios in which there is implementation of EU law. The use of the term of agency is very much connected to the angle considering the Charter through the lenses of vertical division of powers and features the member states as decentralized agents, so to speak, acting on behalf of the Union. And this scenario is then complemented with the derogation one, which captures the situation when the member state is acting based on an explicit derogation provided in EU law or within justification to restriction to one of the fundamental freedoms. That being said, there have been also more detailed takes on how to best approach or capture the different scenarios involving implementation of EU law. And the case law, more specifically, features a test referred to as EDA test, which suggests that what must be verified is, among other things, whether the national legislation at issue is intended to implement EU law, what is the character of that legislation, whether it pursues objectives that are different from those pursued by European law, and whether there are specific rules of EU law that may affect that national legislation. So that test was used in several cases, for instance, in Julian Hernandez, in which the court clarified that the mere fact of the national law being within an area for which the Union has competence is not itself enough to bring a matter pending before a national judge within the scope of EU law. However, those components do not exhaust the situations in which the applicability of the Charter may be triggered, which was well explained in the opinion of Advocate General Bobek in ISPAS, who explained that those criteria represent an indicative guidance and depend actually on the circumstances of a given case. So for more difficult scenarios, the opinion suggests in principle to search for links that show relevant enough specificity between the situation and European law, and which is not necessarily dependent on the overlaps between objectives pursued by the national law on the one hand and European law on the other hand, and recalls that such relevant links may come in particular from the need to ensure effective enforcement of substantive rights that are provided for in European law, with as a limit perhaps a situation in which we consider that national law cannot be reasonably considered as necessary to enforce EU law at issue. So, for all practical purposes, when it comes to the starting question, whether we are within the scope of European law or not, the question most it's perhaps important or useful to keep in mind the old good distinction between agency and derogation situation or implementation and derogation situations, and to begin to focus the attention on identifying whether there is a direct application of EU law, that would be typically a case with a regulation, or whether there is perhaps indirect application of EU law, that will be typically a case with national law that implements a directive, or whether we are within a field that is covered by a derogation when member state acts based on a explicit derogation or within justified restriction. And once we identified one of those broad categories, we may indeed face a scale of situations, some of which will be very easy to connect with European law, while it will be much more difficult with others, which I will now try to flesh out with the help of some recent cases. So the first case I include for today was decided by the Grand Chamber this last summer and connects in principle with the easiest scenario there can possibly be, because when it comes to the answering of the question whether we are within the scope of European law, because this case involves application of a regulation, and more specifically Regulation Dublin III, that allocates among the member states the responsibility to assess applications for international protection. Based on a set of abiding criteria. And although that initial question appeared easy, the question whether we were within the scope of EU law, the rest of the case was less so, because it placed the national judge before the necessity to decide whether it could accommodate a specific remedy claimed by the applicant for international protection when that remedy was not explicitly provided for in the regulation, and when the applicant was an accompanied minor. Unaccompanied minors are a specific categories of vulnerable applicants, identified as such in the regulation, who must therefore benefit from enhanced protection. And to that end, the second paragraph of Article 8 of Regulation Dublin III provides that when such a minor has a relative who can take care of him or her and who is legally resident in a member state that is different from the one in which the application was filed, that other member state becomes responsible to assess the application when this is in the best interest of the minor. And in that way, the minor can live with that relative pending the assessment of the application. So that provision was relied upon in that case by the Greek authorities, which turned to the Dutch authorities asking to take charge of the applicant who had indicated that he had a relative residing in the Netherlands. But that request was rejected. And then that rejection was challenged before the Dutch court. And the Dutch court then faced a very difficult question, whether the applicant must, in that situation, have an opportunity to challenge the refusal. The difficulty came from the fact that on its face, Article 27 of the regulation, which deals with the remedies, on its face limits the available remedies against in respect of the transfer decision. So the precise question raised in that case was whether that provision could be nevertheless relied upon to challenge a refusal to take charge of an accompanied minor. In that respect, the court noted that although the wording of Article 27 of Dublin Regulation did not include that remedy, it did not exclude that remedy either. And based on the classic methods of interpretation of EU law, it looked at the context and the objectives, importance of the objective pursued by that regulation, which, apart from providing a quick mechanism to allocate the responsibility among member states to assess the applications for international protection, also aims at ensuring fundamental rights, including for what was relevant in that case, right for family life, the obligation to have regard to the best interest of a child, and also rights to an effective remedy before a court. And in the light of those imperatives, the court came to the conclusion that the applicant must be able to plead incorrect application of the responsibility criteria, of, including the one that is set out in the second paragraph of Article 8, and that possibility cannot depend on whether the applicant challenges a transfer decision or a refusal to take charge of the applicant, because in both situations, the allocation criteria are binding, but of course, as a matter of fact, there they can be misapplied, and the applicant must therefore be in a position to challenge their possibly incorrect application and seek protection of the rights that derive from those provisions. And the second case, which I included in the presentation, is Torubarov, is another Grand Chamber case that dealt with the situation in which an administrative authority refused to comply with the judgment adopted by the National Court, by which that court annulled a previous administrative decision in the field of international protection. And the problem faced more specifically by the National Court was that under applicable national law, it had only powers to annul and send the case back to the administrative authority, but it could not replace that administrative authority's decision with its own. So now the fact that the court dealing with an administrative law claim may only annul and send the case back is per se not problematic, because seen at the general level, the member states can organize their remedies as they seem fit, and there are different traditions that exist in that respect, of course. But that particular choice may become problematic when it is combined with the refusal of an administrative authority to actually comply with a judgment. So more specifically, the risk in that case was that the national court and the national authority would lock themselves and the applicant with them in a sort of ping-pong in which the court would again annul administrative authority decision and in which that authority would then again adopt a decision which would disrespect the judgment. So in that situation, the national court was in fact not able to ensure the respect of the rules adopted to enforce obligations that flow from qualification directive. And this is why it turned to the court with a question whether the procedures directive, in combination with Article 47 of the Charter, equip the national judge with some powers in that respect. And the court responded that, yes, these provisions do equip the court for that purpose. And the court did this in the following manner. It first relied on the provisions of the procedure directive that require the member state to ensure that there is an effective remedy before a court against certain categories of administrative decisions, among which decisions rejecting applications for international protection. So this is Article 46 of the Procedures Directive. And that provision goes actually even further, because in the third paragraph, it sets out some specific features that review, that the judicial review must have. Namely, it must be full and ex nunc examination of both facts and law, including where it is necessary, examination of the needs of the international protection. And in respect of that precise obligation, the court had already explained in another Grand Chamber case, namely Alheto, that Article 46.3 of the Procedures Directive does not as such concern the situation after the annulment of the decision under appeal, which means that it is for the member states to decide how they are organizing the follow-up stage. But what is important is that even within that stage, the member state must respect Article 47, and it would be against that provision if when we have a judgment in which the court made a new and full assessment of the need of international protection, the administrative authority could still adopt a decision which would be incompatible with the judgment. So in that situation, and unless there are some new elements, that administrative authority has no more discretionary power to grant or to refuse the protection that it was applied for, because otherwise Article 46.3, read in conjunction with Article 47 of the Charter and the respective provisions of the Qualification Directive, would be deprived of all practical effect. And that also meant that when the National Court finds itself in such a difficult situation, it actually has to disapply, if necessary, a possible national law that prohibits the court from rectifying the situation. To move now to the field of derogations, I included these two still relatively recent infringement cases that concern Hungary. Now, infringement procedure is not per se of direct relevance for a national court, for obvious reasons, but what is interesting in those cases is somehow is somewhat a new take that was present on the use that can be made of the Charter. So in those cases, the Commission sought a decision that would state that the member state, in this case Hungary, infringed its obligation that flow from the treaties, and also infringement of a provision of the Charter. So the existence of the infringement of the treaty was observed by the court relatively quickly, but what was new was precisely the fact that there was still this other plea that the Commission was making in respect of the violation of several provisions of the Charter. So the new question was whether the assessment of those pleas would somehow integrate the scrutiny of the compliance within the test of justification to a restriction of a fundamental freedom, or whether the verification of the compliance with the Charter would be done in an autonomous manner or independently. In the first case, what happened was that after concluding that there has been a restriction to free movement of capital, the court observed, in line with the established case law, that restriction can be justified only based on the overriding reasons in public interest or based on the grounds that are foreseen for that purpose by the treaty. And it also added that that restriction must be scrutinized in the light of the fundamental rights. And then, with that, it moved directly to the examination of Article 17, which was relevant in that case, 17 of the Charter, and it did so by reference to the specific conditions that are provided for in that article, concluded that there was a violation of that provision, and then proceeded to the overall conclusion under which there has been indeed a violation of Article 63 of the treaty in combination with Article 17. And in the second infringement case, the court actually looked at both tests, one for the justification of a restriction to fundamental freedom, and the other for the justification of a limitation of a right guaranteed under the Charter, and ran both tests, and at the end of that analysis concluded that Article 63 and the respective provisions of the Charter were infringed. Now, those two cases must be read against their specific procedural framework, namely that these were infringement proceedings, and it's perhaps useful to compare it with the judgment in Segro, which predates both infringement cases and in which involved the same legislation as the one concerned by the first infringement case. And in that case, the court looked at the legislation at issue through the test of justification of a restriction, and that concluded that an independent assessment of compliance with Article 17 was no longer necessary. Now, turning to perhaps another type of derogation, I would like simply draw your attention to a pending case that involves declarations that the member states can make based on Article 55, paragraph 1b of the convention implementing the Schengen Agreement so as to limit the applicability of the principle of ne bis in idem, which is guaranteed under Article 54 of that convention. Article 55 sets out several scenarios when the member states may declare that the principle of the protection under the principle ne bis in idem does not bind them. In situations such as, for what was relevant in this or is still relevant for this case, when the judgment concerns an office or an offense against national security and other essential interests. And interestingly enough, those declarations must be, when they are made by states, must be deposited with the government of Luxembourg, which then has to notify them to others. So as I said, it is a pending case, which the court still has to decide, so I cannot discuss it in any more depth, but it is worth mentioning that the opinion of Advocate General Spunar was published in that case just 1 week ago, in which it is considered that those declarations are in fact incompatible with Article 54 of the Convention. The opinion takes the position that there is a problem with the accessibility of those declarations. Apparently, they seem to concern currently 8 member states, but there is also uncertainty whether the same declaration could be made in future by the member state who acceded to the Union later, and also expresses the view that exception to the principle of ne bis in idem actually hurts the essence, the very essence of the principle, which is even more acute, given that since the time when the convention was adopted, there has been a lot of developments in the area of mutual trust and mutual recognition, mutual cooperation in the field of criminal law, which makes that those declarations become actually today inapplicable in his view. So, as I said, it's a pending case, and we will have to see what will be the take that the court will. What is the position that the court will take? Now, to conclude, I would like to turn to the so-called correspondence clause in the second paragraph of Article 53 of the Charter, which sets the important minimal limit to the protection that has to be provided under the Charter. And that minimal limit, as we know, cannot go beyond the level of protection as it is ensured under the European Convention, as it is interpreted by the court, by the European Court of Human Rights. Now, it is perhaps useful to remind that article, which is today central to the interactions between both systems, has not been the beginning of the interactions between them, actually, because that relevance was confirmed in the case law well before the Charter entered into force. But as with other aspects of the protection of fundamental rights within the Union, the Charter and this equivalent clause has certainly contributed to a greater visibility of the special place that the Convention enjoys within the system of EU law, and that remains unaffected by the fact that Union has not acceded to the Convention for the time being. Now, to give an example of that interactions, I will remain in the field of ne bis in idem, where there have been rather important developments. To explain, it is useful perhaps to recall that the approach to the issue of the application of criminal and administrative proceedings of criminal nature relied, for instance, when Akkerberg-Fransson was decided, on the premise that the second proceedings is precluded is not precluded when the first one was not criminal in nature. So then the attention is or was then focused on identifying of the elements of idem and elements of bis. And once those elements were identified, the prohibition under the principle of ne bis in idem basically was triggered. However, in Menchi, Di Puma and Gadelstein judgments, the court decided to allow the second proceedings to proceed under certain conditions, and more specifically, subject to conditions of the limitations of the right clause in the first paragraph of Article 52 of the Charter. So that means for the case of ne bis idem in those circumstances, that means that the second proceedings is possible, is admissible when the legislation that allows for the duplication of the proceedings pursues objectives of general interest, such as enforcement of tax obligations, but at the same time, both legislations must follow complementary, and that also means different aims. Second condition is linked to the requirement of the coordination between both proceedings, so as to limit the disadvantage that come from the duplication to the minimum. And third, there must be a mechanism that guarantees the proportionality of the resulting sanction. And it's important to know that this shift followed an earlier one, which was made by the European Court of Human Rights in ANB against Norway in 2016, in which the European Court of Human Rights developed a similar test, which is not entirely the same. And under that test, a second proceedings may be combined with the may proceed if there is a sufficiently close connection in substance and time. And to determine whether this is the case, the European Court of Human Rights looks at whether both proceedings address complementary purposes that address different aspects of the given conduct or misconduct, whether the duality was predictable, whether both proceedings have been coordinated so as to avoid duplication at the level of collection and assessment of the evidence, and whether the overall penalty is proportionate. By contrast, there is not much precision about the temporal link, which the court did not mention in the test designed in Menchi. And after Menchi, the next question that came in the wake of that case law was whether that new approach to the principle, ne bis in idem, should be applied when it comes to the enforcement of competition law, which until then relied on a test as it was recalled in Toshiba. And that question was put to the court in Bipost and Nordzucker, two cases decided also by Grand Chamber in March this year. One of the underlying issue in those cases concerned moreover the relevance of the criterion of legal interest as a standalone criterion that was previously used in competition law cases to determine whether the matter involved or not the same. And in both Bipost and Nordzucker, the court made clear that the applicability of the ne bis in idem principle must be assessed in those areas too under the same test as it results from Menchi. And to conclude this time for real, I would like simply note that the interactions between both systems, between European law and the system of the European Convention of Human Rights, do not necessarily run only in one direction. The European Court of Human Rights has been mindful of the specificity of the situations in which the member states find themselves when they implement EU law, and that consideration is embodied in what has been referred to as a presumption of equivalent protection of fundamental rights, which modifies to some extent the modalities of the state liability of the member states under the convention. Moreover, the EU law, the EU legislator has adopted several instruments dealing with procedural rights, for instance, in criminal proceedings, whose subject matter is as such highly relevant for many cases that reach the European Court of Human Rights. And that detailed legislation, such as access to lawyer directive, took inspiration from the case law of the European Court of Human Rights. But that court may actually in turn look at the further details of that legislation and supplement in this way perhaps its own reflection on those matters, which then perhaps opens a potential for the Charter to play a role this time as a source of inspiration, where it actually step out a little bit of the confines of the shadow to which it has to be otherwise restricted. So with that, I would like to stop here.